I had had a little, like, my little sister who was 3 years younger than me that I couldn't just watch fend for the wolves. And so I went from being 5 to being her parent. Yeah, I've had to realize a lot of things, because in order to take care of her and do what I had to do to keep my whole family talking to each other, I had to learn how to deal with myself and make sure that I was okay to be able to do those things.
Hey guys, that was just a little bit from Tessa Hart, today's guest. Tessa is a dear friend of mine and somebody that we go back a few years, actually the last of my active using days and close to the last of her active using days was the last time that we saw each other in real life. So since then, Tessa found out she was pregnant, and that was what spurred her into the awesomeness that is being the wonderful mom and contributor to society that she is today. So I'm really proud of this episode. I am grateful beyond words that she found her recovery. She keeps in touch with me often, and she just celebrated her 1 year. So I thought, hey, let's celebrate that by bringing her onto the show. So, anyway, guys, the title sponsor for today's episode is the Yatra Treatment Center here in Krabi, Thailand, where I reside. If you haven't been following along, my healing journey started when I came to Thailand to attend the 30-day trauma treatment center and experience a residential treatment program. There's EMDR therapy, internal family systems therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. All of this is mixed in with yoga, Tai Chi, mindfulness, meditation, ice baths, just a holistic kind of trauma healing environment. And they're absolutely wonderful at what they do. They're one of a kind in the world. And if you have things that are holding you back in life or traumas that you think you might need to address, certainly check them out. They do have some online options as well, if coming to Thailand isn't an option for you. So check them out, guys. You can learn more about them, including some of the episodes that Mike Miller, the head clinician and co-founder of the Yatra Center, has done here on the Ashes Tossin podcast at huapodcast.com/trauma. And there you'll find links to their website and all of that as well. So thanks for listening, guys. I hope you enjoy this show. It's a special one for me. Hello, everybody, watchers, listeners, supporters of all kinds. Welcome to another episode of the Weekend Ramble on the Ashes to Awesome podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange, checking in from Krabi, Thailand, halfway around the world in Calgary, Alberta. It's my beautiful co-host, Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today, Lisa?
Very good. It's a good Saturday on a long weekend, so I'm good.
How's the weather in Calgary today?
Beautiful. Calgary's weird, right? Like it was snowing yesterday, so there's like fresh snow everywhere, but blue sky today, and it's going to be 19 degrees on Tuesday.
Sounds like Calgary to me. I do not, I should say, yeah. I do miss the warm parts of the winter anyway. But also joining us in virtual studio from Winnipeg, Canada, is a very dear friend of mine, Tessa Hart. How are you doing today, Tessa?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm really glad to have you on. How's the weather doing in Winnipeg today?
Pretty much the same as there. It's kind of like on and off cloudy today, but it was snowing and raining yesterday, so we kind of just got a thin layer of snow everywhere. But it's supposed to be like 19 on Wednesday, Thursday here too, so hopefully winter's up.
I think, yeah, you're probably safe close now. Usually, yeah, at the end of March you should be fine, right? So at least, you know, Calgary standards anyway, from what I'm used to.
Although I have to tell you, the first year I moved to Calgary, so I moved here in 2000, and I moved here at the end of March, and so of course went and got hiking and camping gear, and then was like, May long weekend, going camping. Went camping on May long weekend, woke up in a tent covered in snow with the roof of the tent drooped in, out of the tent, and everything is white. And I was like, okay. And then, of course, I've since learned that Calgarians will laugh at anybody who tries to do something on May long weekend, because it's like a long-standing joke that you just don't do that with nature, and you wait until after May long weekend.
I mean, when you're 20, you do, right? Because whatever, you know, most people don't fall asleep anyway when you're 20, right? You know, so, yeah. And we did a bunch when we were kids, but yeah, I'm too old for that shit now. I would never attempt that.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen, to the listeners and watchers and supporters. So Tess and I go back a couple of years now. The last of our using days were spent in Moose Jaw, where we met when I lived there, and we ended up living there. We parted ways right towards the end of my addiction and getting close to the end of hers as well. Tess has got, well, I'll let her tell her own story, I guess. But Tess, I know your story quite well, so maybe I'll just get you to start. You know what? We'll start the same way I ask everybody. Do you remember the first time you got fucked up?
Yeah. pretty vividly, actually. Okay, wait, what are we fucking up on? What?
The first time you got like messed up, period.
In general?
Drugs, alcohol, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was 13 and I got blacked out hammered with my mom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my stepdad set the house on fire.
Can't imagine why you remember that. Yeah. There's all sorts of, I can already hear Lisa's mind just whirring in the background there. Like just going crazy, right? And I guess, so to you, Tess, and to anybody who's listening who might be new to the platform, Lisa is a psychiatrist in Calgary, specializes in addiction, works with people who suffer with SUD quite often. And typically she gets interested in our guest stories. She is also the mugglest of the muggles, as I finally fondly call her. So.
And I've broached on this before, but even like when you take addiction out of it, right? If it's just mental health, like I'll meet people and we'll talk about whatever they're coming in with, whether it's, you know, depression or anxiety or whatever. And of course, that's what they're most interested in. And usually around like a second or third session, like I'll focus entirely on like their childhood. And it's like, for me, it like all just kind of comes together. Like it all makes sense once I hear like the childhood story. So when someone tells me they get blackout drunk with their mom when they're 13 years old, I'm just like, whoo, like, I don't know if you can tell us more about it, but I'd be curious. Like, is that like looking back now, like, yeah, like what, like you're a mom now. Like, I don't know if you think, you know, differently about that situation as a mom.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. But also like then, so my mom had been in active addiction since I was like 5-6 years old. So I was pretty used to what was going on at that point. And by that point I had kind of started to make the separation between my mom being my mom and my mom being my friend, because I understood that relying on her to be my mom, I was going to get let down 9 times out of 10. But if I had her as a friend, she was a pretty fun person to be around, and I got hurt less. And so now that I have a baby of my own, I look at those things, and I'm glad that I made that distinction so that I still have good memories with my mom, though we may have not been doing the best of things. But I couldn't imagine hurting my
mom. No, right. If we could go back to that first time, do you remember specifically how it made you feel, more importantly, relative to how you felt before you got drunk, kind of thing? I won't lead you into anything. You just answer the question. It's okay if you didn't remember as well. So I'm just...
No, I'm trying to figure out how to word it. So my mom had just left my sister's dad, and they had been together for like 16, 17 years, super abusive, toxic relationship. And she met this guy who was actually a year younger than my older brother, and super fell in love with him, was super infatuated in this relationship. My brother was an adult. He had moved out. My sister moved in with his dad. And I was 13, and I was a very mature 13-year-old. So my mom was kind of just doing her own thing, and I was kind of along for the ride. And she was getting drunk all the time, and like I was a second thought. And so that day when she offered me a drink with her, I was like, well, you know what? I'm finally not going to be like a second thought. And we had a really, really good time until he set the house on fire because he's stupid. It was like the spring, and our whole backyard had a bunch of really tall, dry grass, and he flipped a cigarette butt out the back door, and the whole yard.
Yeah. So did you drink with your mom because you wanted to drink, or did you drink with your mom because you wanted to try to connect with her and thought it was the only way to do it?
Or can you even answer
it that question? It started as a wanting to connect with her sort of thing, and then once I got drunk and kind of was introduced to why people use coping mechanisms like that, then anytime my mom was like, hey, do you want a drink? I was all over it, because I knew that it would lead to me feeling good. And
usually that's an insight that comes long after the fact, right? So that's interesting for sure. Lisa, you can run with this. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just curious, like what, before you found drinking, what were the, and I don't know if you'll remember this, but what were the feelings that you had that drinking helped you escape from?
I was angry. I was really, really mad that my mom couldn't pick me over her addictions, that my whole family got ripped apart, that we were living in the city, and all of a sudden we were living 2.5 hours outside of the city. I had no friends, no one to talk to. We were 7 kilometers from like the closest town. We had no car. But at the same time, I loved my mom so much. And there was a lot of what was going on that I didn't put blame on her for. Like, yeah, she fucked up and she had her addictions, but there was a lot of it that was like situational that I didn't really blame her for. And so it was like being mad at her, but being not being able to be mad at her and wanting to protect her because she's my mom and I love her and it's not her fault. And so, yeah.
Yeah. But it's like awesome that you're aware of that. Because again, one of the things I find is that people, for example, out of that like desire to protect their parent, they can't admit that they were also angry and they were also hurt. And for some people, it takes like a lot of work in therapy to like be able to pull out that they can realize that their parent, just like all the rest of us, we're not black and white, right? We're made up of 10 million shades of gray, and people are not all bad or all good. So it's like super insightful that you are aware of all that. And it sounds like you were aware of it even when you were a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, I knew exactly what I was doing. Because, I mean, I had to grow up really, really fast. I had had a little, like, my little sister who was 3 years younger than me that I couldn't just watch fend for the wolves. And my older brother, who was 7 years older than me, did a pretty good job, like, stepping up and raising me. But the 10-year difference between him and my sister, he wasn't really interested in her. And so I went from being 5 to being her parent like that. And so, yeah, I just kind of realized and had to realize a lot of things, because in order to take care of her and do what I had to do to keep my whole family talking to each other, make sure that my mom was okay, that all these things were okay, I had to learn how to deal with myself and make sure that I was okay to be able to do those.
And the thing is, like, I think when kids grow up in trauma and chaos, they do grow up faster, right? Like, they don't really have a choice in the matter. But at the same time, kids don't have the capacity to truly grow up the way that they need to. Their brain just is not developed. It's not capable, right? But so it's like there's this expectation to function like an adult when you don't have the tools to do it. And, you know, I don't know if you've, looking back, if you can relate to that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's, for example, like my mom used to have house parties and stuff all the time. And like, us kids were home, sure, we'd be in bed, but like, there was a time where my sister had to go to the hospital because she found a bag of my mom's caps behind the couch. And she was fine. She ended up just like riding the trip out in the hospital room. But that was
a
normal
thing. Bag of your mom's what? I'm sorry?
A bag of my mom's caps. Like MDMA capsules.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She came into the living room and she looked at my mom. And she went, "Mom, I'm talking to Jesus." We weren't like a religious household either. So, yeah.
And how old was she at the time?
5, maybe 4. She was in kindergarten.
Wow. And then did that, like, was there child and family services involved? Like, did...
No. As we were running out the door to the emergency room, my mom looked at my brother, who was 16 at the time, and said, "This is your stash."
Okay, gotcha.
And so when we went into the emergency room, they were all like, "Oh, yeah, that kind of thing happens all the time. Oh, blah, it's not a big deal." Yeah, that only ever came into my home when I called them in.
Okay.
Because all my siblings, like my brother had moved out, my sister was living with her dad, and I was living with my mom out in the country. And it was shortly after I had started drinking with her. We were broke as shit. And so the food that was in the house, mom had meals for. You don't just go snack on stuff. And she was next door at the neighbor's place. And my mom was a really frail, small woman. And she had been blackout drinking for like 3 days at this point. So I was hungry. And she started picking a fight with this really, really big Aboriginal woman. And my mom was like 80 pounds soaking wet, 2 fake hips. Like, this was going to go bad. So for her own safety, I'm like, "Mom, like, can we go home? I'm hungry, blah, blah, blah." And eventually I convinced her to come home with me. And as we were walking from our neighbor's place to our place, there was a fence in between that we had to crawl over. And I tripped going over it. And she looked at me, she came out, she's like, "Good, stay on the ground, I fucking hate you anyways." And my mom had said, like, "I should have aborted you," like a lot of awful things, but she'd never told me she hated me before. And so that stung. And then we went in the house and she beat the ever-loving shit out of me from one side of that trailer to the other. And that was another thing that had never happened before. She'd never laid her hands on me. And so I went to bed that night and I woke up in the morning fully ready to adult sit down and talk to her about this situation, because even then I knew that wasn't her. She was drunk. That had nothing to do with me. I was just the person that she took it out on. And I sat down and we talked about it. We had a really good conversation. And at the end of it, she goes, "Well, in my defense though, the last week you have been being kind of a bitch." And so I walked out my door and called CFS and didn't go back.
You never ever went back? Or? Oh, wow. How old were you when that happened?
I was 14.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. I'm just sort of like stuck on that for a minute. Like, you know.
It's a ton, right? Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And the fact that, like, I mean, I'm not surprised it was a profound moment, but like clearly as you're sitting here saying, like, she had said all these other things to me, but she'd never said that. Right? It's like, did you ever like struggle with, because on one hand, I feel like there's this, I don't know if desire is the right word, but like desire to connect with your mom, to be in her field of vision. So it's like, well, if I drink with her, then, you know, I can be with her. But you also had that awareness that your mom behaved in ways because of substances. Like you said, that wasn't really my mom. So was there, did you ever resent the substance and like not want to drink it or want to go pour it all out because you're like, this shit is ruining my mom?
Yes. But I also, okay. So my mom, she abused opiates. That was her main, like she would do whatever she could get her hands on, but opiates was her big thing. And it was because she, when she was 2.5 years old, she was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She had osteoporosis. She had two fake hips, a fake knee, three herniated discs. She had a lot going on. And so even if she didn't abuse her medication, she still needed it, right? And there was a point in my life where I went into the house and I grabbed all of her pain meds and I flushed them all down the toilet. And then I saw what happened. Mm. And I saw how much pain I caused her. And I knew that's not how you do it. That I couldn't just ask her to stop.
That reminds me, Chris, like different scenario, but similar to when you've talked and you've said it a few times, but you saw somebody go through an opiate withdrawal and the pain they were in and how it like impacted.
No, that one wasn't you, but I do remember seeing that a few times too, hon. Yeah. No, for me, it was the first time I'd ever been exposed to it. I've seen lots of people go through being dope sick. The first time I was ever exposed to it, it was like an instant. I will never let somebody go through that if I can help it again. Mm-hmm. Right. And call it enabling, call it whatever you want. But for years after that, if I could help somebody that was dope sick, I would buy them their shit, right? Every time. Because they're not going to quit if I don't help them. They're just going to suffer, right? And you're watching another human being suffer. Suffer is the word too, right?
Yeah.
You know, so.
I'm the same way. Even going through active addiction, if I had this much less and I saw somebody that I could clearly see was dope sick, half of that was theirs. I didn't care who you were.
We've talked about this on the show too. Lisa, I don't know specifically with you, but it's certainly something that's come up. Something that always amazed me. Of course, I was never into opiates personally. But when you saw two people who were addicted to fentanyl and one person would have a couple points left, which is, you know, 0.2 grams and not that much. Knowing that they have no more money, they have no more resources to get more dope. But if somebody next to them was sick, you know, knowing they were going to be sick in 2 hours because they're going to share it, they would still share it almost every time. Yeah. Right. And yeah, it was just kind of this camaraderie of, I know what it's like, man. Right. And it's crazy to see. Right. Mm-hmm. I've also seen the extreme opposite of that with horribly selfish.
Where it's like, you know what? I'm about to run out of dope. That guy next to me has $10 and they're sick and they're too sick to get up. I'm going to take that $10 and make sure that I can.
Yeah. Right. There is that side of it as well. So it's not all roses and, you know, I don't mean to paint it like that, but just the fact that selflessness exists in a place where you have every reason for it not to exist, always kind of blew me in mind.
And that's what I try to explain to people that like have that like stigma and negativity against it. It's nobody woke up and wanted that. It's fucking awful. They are suffering. They are not happy. It's you don't want to be like that. So if someone that's in that situation, you can help somebody not feel as shitty. You're gonna.
Yeah. Right. It's funny. I was doing my comment thing. My war in the comments thing again, Lisa. And so every week I end up, Tessa, telling Lisa about some fucking craziness that I did. So I may have overstepped this time. And it's not often you'll hear me say that. So somebody came in saying some really rude, ignorant things in a post about people who suffer an addiction. And I might have gone to their profile and grabbed a picture of the
grandpa?
Kids. No, this is somebody else. This is a mom who did not react. Because I did the same thing last week, right? With the grandpa.
Yeah,
because
there was the grandpa one and
that was the end of the conversation. This woman went fucking crazy. I did blur out the faces of her kids. Like, I'm not going to post that shit online and you know what I mean? So, whatever. So I blurred out the faces and said, hey, if it's these two, you might have a different, I'm calling the police on you. You can't post pictures of my kids. So it was like,
you actually can. And so at the end of the day, if she puts it on social media, then the world can do whatever they want with those photos, which is why people should be careful.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I blurred out their faces because I'm not a total asshole.
Because you're respectful.
And so just to make that point, and it's like, now you get it.
I was going to say, I think you struck a chord.
Protective?
Yeah.
And of course, she denied that. Just called me a creep and all that.
She's still going to think about that, though. So you accomplished your goal.
That's kind of the way I look at it.
You're not a creep.
I mean,
I know that.
She left the conversation very angry and threatening, but whatever. You know,
that happens when people know that they're wrong.
You get so fucking tired of it. You get so tired of how mean people can be. Right. And like, I don't know how many times people will say it, how many times I've said it. It's that is somebody's kid. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, that could be your kid. And her response, that would never be my kids. I take care of my kids. That would never happen. It's like, oh, you poor lady.
No,
I hope reality never knocks on your door. I hope you get to live in that bubble forever. And I hope reality never knocks on your door. And that you have to think back to conversations like this. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
And actually, I actually feel like people like that, their kids to me, like, so on one hand, I think it's protective if, in fact, there's been no family history of addiction, there's been no trauma, that's protective. But her ignorance is dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. Because drugs are everywhere. They're in the schools, they're in private schools, they're used amongst people who come from money. And so it's like, if you literally believe that could never be your kid, then your poor kid is not going to have the right supervision.
There was a girl that I went to school with. Her dad was a preacher. Her mom had a super, super good job. Beautiful home. She was adopted into the family. Like, this kid had absolutely everything going for her and was super smart. I was really good friends with her. And while I was using, I was staying at a shelter, and I woke up, and the girl sleeping next to me on the mat on the floor was the valedictorian. Fucking dad was a priest of my class. And she had everything under the sun going for her. And she went to a party. Parents hadn't educated her on everything because that could never be my kid. And now she was sitting right there next to me. She has since had a baby girl and has been clean for like 2 years. So, but.
Yay.
Yeah.
No, I think like people need to be talking to their kids. Like, I have a 6.5-year-old, you know, and you obviously have to be mindful of their age. Exactly. Yeah. You know, but like she went through, when she was 5 years old, her birthday party was Michael Jackson themed. She was obsessed with Michael Jackson at 5 years old. And,
that's awesome.
You know, and right. And also around that age, she started to become aware of death, right? That death was a thing. And so, you know, she had asked me one day, like, is Michael Jackson still alive? And I was like, no, he died. And she's like, well, how did he die? And I told her, I said, you know, sometimes people take medication they're not supposed to take. Sometimes people, you put things in their mouth that's bad for their body. And that's what he did. And, you know, he probably died by accident. But I think, you know, you need to be aware that this is out there in the world and talking to your kids. Because, if you don't tell your kids, someone else is going to tell them.
I'm going to be completely age-appropriately transparent, but completely transparent with my daughter about where I've been, what things are like. She's gonna know. And really, like, I learned by like seeing things, and as many bad stories as she was also an incredible mom. It's the more knowledge you have, the better you are, and like the better prepared you are for things. And any questions she has will be age appropriately answered.
Yeah. And then Tessa, can you tell me, just because I don't know your story, I know that Chris does, but like, so you started drinking with your mom when you were 13, and then what happened from there? Because I know you guys knew each other, but
So I ended up moving in with my grandparents, and then I finished school living with them. I would go to like parties on the weekend and whatever, but I graduated with honors. I had like a full time, like I did really, really good through high school and stuff. And then I moved to the city for a year, and my mom was like on and off living with me. And then she passed away of an overdose really abruptly right after my 19th birthday. And after I graduated, I started putting all my time and energy into taking care of her. And when she passed away, I was honestly really lost, and I didn't know what to do. And And I had my brother living with me at the time, and I knew that she had died of a fentanyl overdose. Everyone around me was dying of a fentanyl overdose at the time because it had like just become popular, and I was in a really bad mental state. And I knew where I could get my hands on some. And so I went and I bought them with the complete intentions of overdosing. I went home, I walked into my brother's room, and I said, hey, I have this in my pocket. I'm going to go into the bathroom and get high. And that was like my, you know, last ditch final cry for help. But he told me to come knock on his door when I was done so that he knew I was okay. Wow. Yeah.
And so the intention had been overdose, but did you overdose?
Nope. And then I kept trying for like a week, and then I ran out and I was like, well, fuck, I guess this is over. But then withdrawals started, and then I just kind of chased that for a while, and then I ended up homeless, and that was really rough. But then I got on the methadone program and I picked my shit up. I got custody of my little sister. I moved out of the city and I was doing really good for like a year and a half. And then I was in a relationship and he ended up cheating on me. And so I got like really down in the dumps, moved back to the city. The person that I was staying with ended up being an addict. And so I relapsed and was on dope for a while. And when I met Chris, actually, I was on my way to BC to go try to get help there, because there, the help in Manitoba is just, it's not here. And I figured if I can get out there, there'll be something. And on my way there, the person that was driving me, we stopped to go camping. And I had sent him to the gas station with like $200 in his pocket. Okay. He grab and goed the gas and stole like $200 from in the gas station and then ripped into our provincial parking or camping spot, took the plates off, and it was like, everything's fine, everything's fine. So sure enough, the cops came, impounded the car, took him, and I was just stuck in the middle of nowhere in my little camping thing for like 3 days there. And the guy in the campground next to me ended up driving me back to Regina, where I met our mutual friend who introduced me to Chris. And then really, he took me in because he felt bad for me and kind of saved my ass.
Yeah, it's just crazy time. Yeah, I was actually, we had met, I was taking her back into Regina after hanging out for a couple of days, and we didn't make cutoff, eh? I guess you lost your spot at the YMCA, or YWCA. Yeah.
So, and it was like 11 o'clock, and I'm sitting outside with all my stuff on the curb, and he's the only person I knew. So I called him. I was like, I have nowhere to go. And he turned right back around and grabbed me, all my stuff, and brought me home with him. And
that's crazy. Yeah.
I'm not surprised to hear that part of the story.
I had a thing. I collected strays along the way quite a bit.
I mean, I can't, you often refer to yourself as what was it? Crackosaurus or some name.
Crackosaurus Rex. Yeah.
Right. I can't really picture it. Like I try sometimes. I'm like, I can't really picture what that looked like, but I certainly can't ever picture you being mean to somebody.
It's not typically what I did. On occasion, of course, but never. Yeah. I mean,
I remember there being an instance of somebody, we thought that they had left with a large quantity of something that wasn't theirs. And being the nice person that he is, like calmly texted her, I put my steel toe boots on. I was like, let's fucking go. We went to her house. I like ripped it. I was ready to beat the absolute shit out of her. She's like, no, we're going to do this nicely. I was like, no.
Oh my God. And you remember how that ended up, right? Yeah,
we had it the whole time.
It was in my pocket the entire time. Yeah. I'm so glad that we didn't do something when we got
there. Yeah, I'm glad I didn't beat the snot out of her,
It was like, no, you're coming back to my place until we find it.
That's what happened. We had her there for like 2 hours until we found it. I mean, she had water and she was good, but...
It was in your pocket. Yeah, right? Yeah, it was in my pocket the whole time, right?
They were deep, weird talking.
Yeah.
That was interesting for sure. Tessa, I want to talk about the time that after that. So after we parted company, there's a few months in there. Because that would have been September. So about a year, I guess. And you got sober in
March 8th of 2023 was my last day.
Okay. So not quite a year.
March 28th.
Later.
No, it is March 8th.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. She messaged me last night to say, hey, you know, I was like, oh, well, doesn't that work out that you're coming on the show? Right.
So, yeah.
That's why I made that post on Facebook about her and, you know, to congratulate. And I don't even really want to talk too much about the time in between their tests. You find out you're pregnant. How's the recovery journey look for you from there?
Get it fucking done. No, I found out that I was pregnant, and the fear that washed over me, and not because I didn't think that I could like take care of a baby or whatever, but the fact that there was no more fucking around. Like it had to be done, and I didn't know if I could do that. And so it was a really hard like battle of, am I gonna be capable of cleaning myself up as fast as I need to so that I don't impact her, or do I make this other medical choice to not have this negatively impact her? So there was that I was tossing around in my brain, and I had just started methadone at the time, but I was still using while my dose was getting like figured out and everything. And I went to my doctor the next day and I told him what was going on, and we kind of figured out a bit of a plan, because I knew that if I did get everything together, that she was going to save my life, that once I had her, there was going to be no relapse. And there hasn't been, like, it's not even a thought that I have, because anytime I'm even a little bit upset, I look at her and everything's just, it's okay again. But I found out that I was pregnant at the end of January, and the last day that I used was the end of March, and it caused... And I was really open, like, with my partner about it, because how we met, actually, I was about to hitchhike back to Saskatchewan. It was, like, midnight, and I was saying goodbye to my best friend, and I was going to go hitchhike all the way back, because Chris was the only person that I knew would make sure that I was okay. And I was walking past the bar, and it was really late. It was kind of cold. I didn't have any dope in my pocket to do this whole trip, so I was a little unsure about that. And her dad walked past me and was like, oh, like, where are you going? We ended up talking, and he let me spend the night at his house. And I told him what was going on, and he was like, yeah, you don't have to, like, go hitchhike. You can stay here and figure some shit out. And then after a day or two, I was like, hey, I just feel like I should let you know I'm a little bit of a junkie and, like, probably not a person you want to have in your house. He was like, no, I kind of figured there was something going on. Let's figure this out together and kind of let me... stay here and get on methadone. He made sure that I didn't have to go and do anything illegal to bridge me from getting on my methadone. Yes. So I was, thankfully, I had a huge support in that way. And so when I found out that I was pregnant with her, I told him, I was like, look, I don't know what to do about this. And he had my back every step of the way in that. And without that, I don't think I would have been able to do it.
That's awesome. And is he still in your life now?
Yeah, I'm sitting in his house right now.
Okay.
He's playing with our baby in the living room.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome.
So, Tess, something else happened in between there that I just remembered. So Tess actually did a Memorial Monday episode with us way back in the beginning. It was like the third or fourth one, actually.
That's one of the reasons I came home. I had a weird gut feeling that I needed to come home and see my big brother, Zach. And I spent like 3 weeks from the day that I got home just hunting him down. And this girl was like, yeah, okay, he's at my house. But even through my whole addiction, I took pride in my appearance. I did not look like an addict. And so when I came up to you and I was like, hey, I'm looking for this person, take me to your house, you're probably not going to trust that. You're going to go make sure with the other person that I'm not like a cop or something, which I totally understood. And instead of going back and saying, hey, Zach, your sister's looking for you, she went shopping for 6 hours instead, and my brother overdosed. And so I still kind of carry, like, I should have been there to save him. I should have just said, fuck her. I knew where the house was, but I didn't know. But I remember finding out, because I was still standing in that parking lot where she left me, like, 4 hours later. And someone was like, oh, some ginger overdose. And I was like, hold the fuck on. What ginger? Where? And I found out, and I hysterically sobbed in a random parking lot. I don't even know how long.
Well, I mean, that survivor's guilt is understandable, Tess. Very. It's also not rational, but.
No, not at all. But.
When is emotion rational anyway, right? So,
yeah,
you
know. Exactly.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. That was episode 24, by the way, if that. You know, it's kind of, there's 200 episodes ago, right? You know, put that in perspective, 200 and some odd.
Hey, I like your shirt. Can I order a shirt with my sweater?
What? Yeah, of course you can. Well, your sweater's probably on the way, but yeah, we'll get you a tank top. Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Hell, we could do negligees with the You Are Loved on them, right? That's a thing.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah.
Hey, night shirts?
On the butt. Yeah. Sorry.
Night shifts.
I would actually, right. Yeah, like
literally anything you can imagine.
Yeah.
Literally that anything you can imagine. Yeah. Yeah.
And you could still do a night shirt. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's so cute. But you could totally could do a night shoes. Shirt and put your loved on the butt. Why not?
Why not? Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean,
and
hell,
Tessa, can I ask about
what you want? Right. Go ahead.
Can I ask about Zach? So is this the brother that you said was how many years old? Seven?
He wasn't my biological brother. When we were all living with my mom and she was kind of, when you're an addict, she was a functioning addict at this point, and my brother used to have like all his friends come over all the time. It was like 2-3 in the morning, and I had gotten up to use the washroom, and they were having a bonfire in the backyard, and I heard this teenager in my backyard talking about how hungry he was. My mom had always taught us that if someone's hungry, you feed them. So I made him a sandwich, and I had made cinnamon buns or something that night, and so I brought them outside to him, and I gave him the sandwich. He just started crying. I didn't understand why. I was like 11 years old. And come to find out that his parents had both abandoned him when he was like 12 and taken off to BC, and nobody had ever done anything nice for him up until like that point. And so from that point on, we were just, he was my big brother.
Yeah. Super sad. And I think, you know, everybody, when something bad happens, right, I think we always think, well, what if? And there's an infinite number of what ifs, because it's like if we do anything different in this moment than what we're doing, the future will be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's always the, well, what if I had done, again, there's an infinite number of things. It doesn't change the reality of what's happened. And so it just kind of tortures you for nothing. But I think it's also very normal.
Yeah, that is right.
Yeah. And what about your biologic brother? Is he okay?
For the most part, like he's not like an addict or anything like that. He kind of just, he has some like mental health issues that he doesn't really deal with. So he works like a minimum wage job and has his little apartment, and he's doing all right.
Yeah. And are you still close with your little sister? Because it sounds like you were sort of like a mom to her growing up.
I was until very, very recently, actually. She was in an abusive relationship, and so I went and I rescued her from that, and I brought her into my house, and I set her up a bedroom in my basement, and she spent 3 weeks eating all of my food, dirtying my house, and not going to any of her meetings. And so I told her that she had to go to her meetings and stop doing nothing or get out of my house. And she barricaded herself in my basement until I had to call the cops and get her.
Well, hopefully that's a temporary setback in the relationship.
I mean, I'm really hoping that she smartens up and gets the help she needs. And I love her. Yeah. She's my little sister.
Of course, right.
I still texted her the next day and was like, did you get up and go to the thing you were supposed to?
Yeah, it's a lot though. Hey, Tessa, like you've been through a lot in your life, you know? And yeah. And some of it's still there, but I'm glad you've got your little girl, right? Because it sounds like,
you
know, she's that reminder and motivator to keep doing what you're doing, you know?
Well, so that... and I think of having her as like that part of my life ends where she starts. And so it was like a complete 180 fresh start. Let's all of that happen where this is ground zero, and it's looking at it that way has allowed me to be a lot happier with her and just with everything else that's gone.
That's a wonderful outlook to have. It does remind me, and I said it in that Facebook post about your tests. I just posted a reel, and Lisa, this is from Sonia Johnson's first episode with us. I don't know if you've caught that reel that I posted yesterday about her the day before.
I don't think so, no. Not yet.
But she tells us that in her story, you often hear the, You have to quit for yourself. It can't be for anybody else. And
I did see yes.
Yeah. And she says for her, that wasn't her story. Right? Yep. For her,
yep.
She didn't think she was worthy of recovery.
I didn't matter. Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. No, so, I wasn't going to quit for me.
So that's why yesterday, Tess, I asked you specifically, did you quit when you found out you were pregnant? Because I didn't know that that was the correlation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that
so
was
when I
it.
Made that post was... and I mentioned it, right? Yeah.
And this is part of why, this is part of why I believe in mandated treatment, you know, and Tessa, I'll just like preempt that with saying, to me, mandated treatment is not appropriate for everybody with addiction.
No, but the people are losing their marbles on the street corner, 100% should be put in mandated treatment. 100%.
You know, because I hear stories like this often, like I'll hear stories like Sonia's where she is pretty open about the fact that that being in jail is what saved her life. You know, I also, because of the work I do, like I work on an adult inpatient psychiatry unit. So for example, we'll get people who get admitted to hospital in a state of psychosis, that is drug. In the early part of being on the unit, they sometimes want nothing to do with me, nothing to do with the hospital. And then, you know, we'll keep them there. Even within a week, the change in their perspective is shocking, right? And suddenly they'll, a week in, they'll be saying, you know, can we get that addiction team to come see me? Like, can we actually talk about those residential programs I could go to? And again, it's like if they hadn't had a period of kind of
being able to come down and regulate their brain chemistry. And yeah, because you're not thinking rationally when you're like that. Your brain is in fight or flight mode.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know? And so, yeah, I think sometimes, yeah, I just think people in that active phase of recovery or of addiction, sorry, they don't believe they can do it. They don't think they're worthy of doing it. They don't believe there's the help that they need to do it. Like there's so many of these different stories, but.
Before I had Emery, I had tried to get clean twice. I got on the methadone program once and did pretty good. And actually I was almost done the methadone program. And that's where my hiccup was. Is I went down on my dose too fast and started to not feel good. I was down to 3 milligrams. I was so close.
Oh, wow.
But the second time that I wanted to get clean, I was dating my dealer. And so I was going through a lot. And we had ran out. I had gotten sent 4. We went and picked up again. And now we woke up the next morning and there was nothing anywhere to be found in the whole house. And I didn't even remember the last 24 hours. And I sat up and I looked at him and I said, I can't do this anymore. You can leave. You can stay. I'm about to ride this the fuck out. And I did. My grandma ended up where I was staying. I couldn't walk. I couldn't move. Like, they were like, it's a fucking thing out of here. So my grandma came and carried me to her car. And I gave her a list of places she could take me. Because at that point, I was done this fight. I just wanted to go get high. This was horrible. And she was like, you can't walk. You can't do anything right now. And I'm like, no, fucking take me here. And she took me to St. Boniface Hospital and she put me in a wheelchair and she left me at the door. And they took me to the back and they like got me off because I was having seizures and passing out. It was ugly. And they put me in detox over Christmas and I did pretty good. And I made it to the other side of it where I started to feel better again. And then when I checked out of detox, I had nowhere to go. And the only place that I had to go was with other addicts. And I couldn't go stay with them unless I was using, because they couldn't trust me unless I was using. And it was December. December in Manitoba is fucking cold.
And Tessa, like, did you have support? You know, I mean, because we always talk about how I think a large number of people who listen to this podcast are family members. And hence we talk a lot about the you are loved message, right? But, you know, your mom had died of an overdose. Did you have people that you felt could help you get well?
Yes and no. Like, my family is really, really small. I have my brother who had his own shit going on. My sister was younger than me. I'm not close to any of my aunts and uncles or anything like that. And I have my grandparents who dealt with my mom's active addiction for so long. And by that point, they had already taken me into their house once and I robbed them blind. And so they were kind of hurt by what I did and had done in their eyes as much as they could to help me. And them enabling me essentially wasn't going to help me get anywhere better. So they were doing the tough love sort of thing. And I was on my own to figure it out. And then I was very mad at them. And I was mad at my sister who wouldn't let me in her apartment. And I was mad at all my friends that wouldn't let me in. Looking back at it now, I wouldn't have let me in.
It sounds to me, Tess, like similar to my experience. That's a perceived lack of connection, right? Because you would have had to concede to some things in order to receive the help that you needed from them at that time, right? To be let back in the home, to be whatever, right? You'd have to address some of your behaviors that were a result of the addiction, right? Because correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like your grandma's a pretty big part of your life now.
Oh yeah, she definitely, right? She's a huge part of my life and my daughter's life now. And we've had a few instances where we've been on and off again, rocky. And actually, when I got out of the relationship and I started
using it, that's normal fucking life, is what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when they let me into their house the first time, my grandma was so supportive of my addiction, and she was taking me to get me on Suboxone, and there was a long, long waiting list, and she didn't want to see me sick, so she made sure that I had enough dope to make sure that I wasn't sick until I got into my Suboxone appointment. And where I started stealing from her was just enough dope to not be sick wasn't good enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, sure. Right. Exactly. And that obviously it hurt them because they were already draining their retirement fund and letting me smoke dope in their home. And they were doing as much as they could in their eyes to help me. And I just said, fuck you.
Yeah.
I didn't. I didn't.
Because I also remember when we were in Moose Jaw, your grandparents showing up and helping you out, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. They brought me a whole bunch of clothes and sent me like Amazon, like shampoos and conditioners. And I tell my grandma all the time that she loves me a lot more than I deserve.
Well, not more than you deserve, just enough, right? I don't like that.
I mean, again, Tessa, like I would say, as a mom, is there something that your daughter could do that would ever make you not love her? And so it's no different, right? Like you might look back and think that you did some terrible things when you weren't well, but just like you would never not love Emery, I'm guessing your grandma would never not love you, right?
Well said. You can cry if you want a little bit. Because I am a little bit.
Right?
Yeah. Your grandma did comment on that post this morning as well. Which
she did.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I've heard so much about you. Right? I never actually met her, so yeah.
Actually, she we were in the car the other day, and she was like, "So, do you still talk to Chris?" I was like, "Oh yeah, like, all the time." She was like, "Oh okay, so he was there when we came to Moose Jaw," and I was like, "Yeah," and I told her actually like our whole story, and she was like, "Wow, you guys like do go back." I was like, "Yeah, he's a good dude." Yeah. But yeah, at least once a week, my grandma texts me like, "You are loved," with a little heart. And so I always screenshot it.
That's awesome. Yeah, but you know, I feel like, because Chris, you said that, you know, you think it's a perceived lack of connection. And like, I just keep running over that in my head because I'm like, it sounds like grandma was there for moral support. But because of some of the behaviors, there were these boundaries that at that time, she was not willing to have you back in the home. And, you know, I see this a lot with patients where they show up and I'm like, is this perceived or is this real? And even if it's real, sometimes it's understandable because of history, right? But I'll have patients who show up and they have nowhere to go. The only place they can go are places where people are actively using. And there's like, from my perspective, I'm like, there's no way you're going to go there and stay sober. Like, that's not going to happen.
No.
And so, you know, just from the perspective of resources and what I think should exist out there for people to get help, like hearing your story, Tessa, like, I totally get where your grandma was coming from at the time, but I also,
1,000.
Right? I can very much, though, feel that for you, you probably felt like there was nowhere to turn, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like,
yeah, it
how do you,
very hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, and addiction is such a monster that it's like, when you feel like you have nowhere to go, how do you beat it?
Yeah. Yeah. Where do you start?
You know? Yeah. But you did it.
Well, yeah,
you did it.
Yeah, you did.
You're doing it. Right. You did it. You're doing
it.
Yeah, I'm doing it every day.
Right.
That's awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for that, Tess. I really am, you know. At the beginning of that post, I did mention that I've said it out loud. Like, could we just, a win would be really fucking nice, you know, because it just, as the platform grows, there's more and more people messaging and often their mothers, grandmothers, and you just get so discouraged by the numbers. But if you just stop and focus for a minute, I mean, you're a success story. Right? That's great. Right.
As are you.
Are you.
Our mutual friend. Who's now sober? Never saw that coming. I thought, for sure. So
no, me either.
The mutual friend that we're talking about, and we won't use her name because it's not, I don't think that's appropriate to do right now. But Lisa, when I talked about the paramedic who, after me doing CPR for like 10 minutes while I waited for the ambulance, this is the same friend. So Tess, I don't know if I ever told you about this, but she had overdosed multiple times over a couple of days too. But we didn't have Narcan in the house. And I did CPR on her until the paramedics showed up. And on their way out the door, the paramedics said, "We'll see you later." And I just, like, I wanted to punch him out. I was so pissed off that he could say that. And of course, at the time, my emotions were, you know, and I care about people. And this person just died. Fortunately, was brought back. But, like, she was dying and I was panicking. And
yeah, like, that's somebody I care about.
Right? Like, what?
And oh my God.
Of course, now, through a different lens, I understand. I try to understand how,
that's,
how hard
no,
it must
no,
be for
that's
first
not
responders. No, but, and you're right, it's not okay, but I can understand how it gets to that place, right?
Yeah,
if
for
you
sure.
See
you
that
know
person
what? I, and I'm
six guilty times of, in 2 days, you know, you're just like, when's it stop, man? Like, when's it stop?
I'm guilty of that, actually, in my active addiction. There was a house that I lived in, and there was a girl that used to come over all the time. And if she was in the house, it was like, oh, fuck, let's make sure we know where this is, like, she's going to go down at some point. And it was to the point where it was like, there was a couple times where I was the only person that would bring her back because she had gone down so many times that everyone was like, well, fuck it.
Yeah. Right. So imagine being a first responder who's not privy to that lifestyle, who's not even getting to get high. And I've said this to many people that were using fentanyl around me. You don't get it because you're fucking high. Sure. You've been around and you brought people back, but you're high when it happens. The rest of us that aren't using that shit are just sitting around hating the fact that you're using it and then watching somebody we care about die. And
literally
it's horrible and it's shitty and it's traumatic and it sucks, right? So to somebody who's spent how many times, how many hours of their day running around Narcanning people as this epidemic gets worse and worse, you know
it's
what I mean?
Awful.
Pretty easy to see how
Even
they get
now
there.
Now that I'm not
right,
using, you know? I always keep one in my bag when I'm going out because there have been many times where I've been like, well, I guess I have to get off my bus and go Narcan that person in the bus shack because all their friends are just standing around getting high while they're falling over. The
realities of living in a city like...
And that I don't understand
like
either.
City,
like,
but...
if you're in a group and you're all getting high and someone starts going down, why do we just shuffle over a little bit and let that person die?
Because dope. That's why. Right? It's fucked up. You know? Yeah, it is. Listen, we've come to the top of the hour, so which means it's my favorite part of the show, and that's Daily Gratitudes. So, Tessa, what you got for Daily Gratitudes today?
All right, I'm going to start off strong with, how many do I got to get?
Three? We don't put limits on gratitudes. That'd be
my
crazy.
Baby's
right?
Pretty, yeah. My baby's pretty amazing. She's 7 months old now, and it's been the greatest 7 months of my life. I'm grateful for the fact that I'm a little over a year sober. Feels really good. I'm grateful for the fact that winter is almost over and things are going to get sunny out. And I'm grateful for friendships like this.
Awesome. Lisa, how about you? What you got for some gratitude?
I'm grateful the sun is shining. I'm grateful that it's a long weekend and I have very few commitments and can just hang out with my family. Yeah. And I'm grateful, Tessa, to get to hear your story. And again, like, you know, we'll talk sometimes about how we feel like it's a battle. There's, you know, we're never going to win when it comes to sort of the drug, you know, the epidemic that exists right now. Uplifting to hear a story like yours, right? A success story. It, I think it does everybody good to hear them.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. For myself, ladies, I'm grateful for you, Tess. I am. I'm so fucking happy you made it. I really am. I am grateful once again to my family. My education visa, as I was telling you ahead of time, is looks like it's squared away. So I will have a year of stability for the first time in 10 years, maybe something like that, where I won't be worried about what's going to happen at the end of the month. So pretty excited about that. Right? Really excited about that. So I can stay here in Thailand, learn the language, which will help with the whole isolated feeling that comes here quite so often. I might be able to find some cup of noodles or ramen that isn't too spicy. If I can read a little bit of Thai, that'd be nice.
You can just go for like the green colored one.
There is one that I know now. And if I get the wrong shade, I'm screwed. And there's an entire aisle of ramen here. Like, I'm not pissing, like in the grocery store, it's a whole aisle and it's still just too damn spicy, right? Like, there's just nothing. So there's one flavor that I can buy. Right? But that said, like, I eat like one cup of noodle a day. And other than that, it's to say it's sweet potatoes, and carrots. That's what I eat all day, every day.
Yeah, and my three favorite vegetables.
Now
too.
Butter because of you, right? So, yeah. Well, I'm trying real hard to lose weight, right? And it's starting to fly off like really fast now, right? Because it's, you know, between keeping it active with Sunny and eating so much better, you know? So, and I love sweet potatoes. Love them, right? Like I could.
They're good.
I'm good. Absolutely, they are, right?
They're delicious. I'm with you.
I got my rice cooker, which acts as a steamer. So I just, yeah. No, just steam them. I'm good. I didn't even have butter on them until Lisa went and mentioned it the other day. Next thing you know, I'm at the grocery store, like resisting the urge to look over my shoulder as I buy butter because I felt guilty for buying it.
You know, a little bit of brown sugar.
Shh. Just shut your mouth.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not buying brown fucking sugar. Yeah. Okay. No. Anyway, I'm also grateful to every single person who continues to support us. Like, comment, share, buy the hoodies, buy the tanks. Guys, I really need that. The show pays my bills, but just everything else comes in the way of support from people and, you know, buying the hoodies and what have you. So at least I'm really looking forward to you getting that white one. I don't know if you saw the white one on Rachel from Addict with Purpose.
I didn't.
Oh, nice? Wait till you see it. Fucking awesome. Yeah, that looked incredible. I'll send you over the post. Anyway, every time you guys do any one of these things, getting me a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to make a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you're in active addiction right now, today could be that day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend. Reach out to a family member. Call into detox. Go to a meeting. Pray. Go to church. I don't give a shit. Do whatever it is you got to do to get that journey started. It is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, just taking the time to listen to our weekend ramble here. If you can just take one more minute out of your day and text that person, let them know they are loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
Love.
A little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back.